sia molto interessante sull'origine di questi sviluppi, queste prove del carcere, confronto di Shabbat, qui sicuramente diciamo tesoro nel riflettere su questo argomento e il collegamento delle differenze tra Shabbat e il genocidio e l'unicità di Cancun con altri disastri o catastrofi. Adesso andiamo avanti ad ascoltare il professor Daniel Blackman, che a Francia mi ha spiegato che quello che sta a dirci è il frutto di un lavoro di oltre 10 anni negli archivi d'Europa e altri, per studiare e mettere in luce quello che è stato fino ad oggi trascurato, quello che egli chiama l'ultima fase del genocidio nazista. Poi creiamo le conseguenze, conoscendo questo nuovo terribile momento del Shoah, del genocidio, cosa facciamo, no? Imparando questi nuovi fatti da parte del storico. Adesso do la parola a professor Daniel.
Thank you very much. I'd like to take this opportunity to first of all thank my two friends and colleagues, Farah, who invited me here. As a matter of fact, this is the second time that I'm visiting for the same occasion, the Memorial Day, 27th of January. The first time was in 2006, as I remember, or 2004. And in inviting me this time, Mara wanted to take advantage of my recent book that was just published in Italian, which I'm very proud of, as a matter of fact, and to take the opportunity to produce some of my conclusions that research, and also to connect it with the topic of this seminar, this conference that we're having today, which is Holocaust of Shoah and the institutional responsibility. Genocide studies and the wake of debates surrounding the punishment of those who perpetrate such crimes have come a long way since 1948, when the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. As we know, the Convention left quite a few holes and unsolved problems, both in defining various cases of genocide and in establishing and institutionalizing legal setting that would be up to the task of punishing perpetrators of this crime under international law. The recurrence of mass murder crimes in the concluding decades of the 20th century and in our decade, such as the genocide in Rwanda, the ethnic cleansing and murder crimes in Yugoslavia in the mid-1990s, and the genocide in Western Sudan since the beginning of this century, has led to far-reaching changes in the deployment of the international legal system to contend with the phenomenon. In 1994, the United Nations established the first international court for war crimes perpetrated in Rwanda and Bosnia. By 2007, 140 member states of the UN had ratified the 1948 Convention, making it possible for survivors of mass murder crimes to receive assistance under international law in defining crimes attempted against them as genocide, as well as assistance for perpetrators of the crime who are found to be justiciable and punishable under the UN Convention. The 1948 Convention is a product of events that occurred in the 20th century and the international system's response to them. From the legal standpoint, it cannot be applied retroactively to crimes committed before 1941, convent ended. The familiar rule in law, nullum crimen sine lege, created a barrier to the prosecution of perpetrators of genocide who committed their crime before the convention was adopted. The Allied International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg, of course, followed by the American, British, and Soviet military tribunals, did not accuse even one more criminal of genocide. Of course, one should distinguish between the tribunal in Nuremberg and the military instances of the Allies of 1946-1947 that dealt with crimes committed in concentration camps, to which I relate below. In any event, it is absolutely clear that the Nazi genocide during World War II was the act that the initiators and authors of the 1948 convention had in mind above all, not only due to the Raphael Lemkin's activity, but also given the later problems that the Nuremberg trials illuminated. Therefore, the convent was phrased and designed to suit not only cases of genocide that correspond to the Nazi example, but also the genocide that preceded it in the 20th century, that of the Armenians by the Ottoman Turks, started in 1950. The international legal and political problems that constrained and encumbered the possibility of defining and profiling genocide in the 1948 convention, coupled with the occurrence of genocides and similar crimes since the 1950s, led researchers in various disciplines, sociology, political science, and law, to propose additional definitions of genocide and other mass murder crimes that the drafters of the UN Convention totally overlooked. One of the most important of them, in both historical and legal terms, is the one the sociologist Leo Cooper, the American sociologist Leo Cooper, first identified and defined as genocidal massacre, as tested subsequently by researchers such as Helen Fine and recently the French sociologist Jacques Semlin. This category, not currently diagnosed in the 1948 convention, related to mass murder, indicates that take place in a limited area against victims who belong to a specific group or community that is affiliated or identified with the border. Genocide massacre is sometimes a prelude to an action being planned against all members of the victim group at issue. Such cases, Cooper found, may occur in three ways: organized by the state, by the local community, or by combination of both. Other scholars add the genocide massacre need to be limited to events perpetrated by the state or by agents who act with the state's authorization. It may also be the product of local corruption following from an internal conflict in a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, or multicultural community. In such a case, it may be limited in time and space, constituting what one of the researchers defined as genocidal moments. Without any doubt, we can conclude that emphasis on the centrality of the ideological component in the preparation of genocide is the product of post-1948 research, since the convention does not concern itself with question of the conceptual or ideological motivation that underlies the genocidal act. Historians who have investigated anti-Semitism and its centrality in the development of the Marché, leading to the annihilation of the Jews in World War II, made a definitive contribution in this issue. By this, be this as it may, the multidisciplinary occupation with this area of inquiry has resulted in the messing of methodological evidence that stresses the need to examine each case of genocide from numerous angles. Understanding the years of history behind the development that led to it, the social infrastructure in which it took place, the ideological elements, the decision-making process, and the decision-makers' background, aspects of economic utility, and struggle over the national living space, to name only a few. Without dismissing the importance of the totality of these factors, I wish to focus here on the one element that I consider the most complex of all, the ideological element. No serious researcher today fails to consider ideology an important and fundamental element in the powering of genocide. Although different scholars define its attribute in different ways. Racism and xenophobia are important elements in this ideology. Notwithstanding this, we find it difficult to unambiguously determine exactly how far the influence of the eliminationist racist ideology went in the mind of the individual murderer. This question stood at the forefront of several historiographic controversies in the 1980s and the 1990s. Although these controversies need not to be examined here, the issue of the practical limits of ideology remains cloudy to this day, even though the fact of its existence and its importance is shaping the worldview of large segments of a society is undisputed. The racist ideology or biological anti-Semitism in the Nazi case was the framework within which the Weltanschauung of German society was molded. It presented the roots of existence at the national community, at personal level, and it created a conceptual and emotional stew that allowed myth and politics to intermingle and acquire pragmatic meaning under the leadership of the Nazi Party. It was a component in the political vision of the national leadership, a vision in which much of the society believed since Hitler took power in 1933. However, the closer the war came to its decision, and afterwards, final stages, the more complicated and contradictory the Nazi ideological extermination policy became. This final phase of Nazi genocide, which took place mainly in 1945, during the death marches and the evacuations of the concentration camp, had hardly called for a scholarly attention until now. I would like to underline a few of its mostly significant characteristics. In the last year of the war, the annihilation policy took a different and new complexion relative to the one that exhibited in previous periods. The first indications of this may be seen as early as late 1943, when the war reached its tipping point. The contemplating that juncture in time, one has to take two important elements into account. First, most of European Jewry, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, was no longer among the living. Only the circumstances specific to each and every location. Most of those who had survived the previous 2 years of extermination actions in Eastern Europe or in the Reich itself were interned in various slave labor settings. Second, much of Himmler's attention was divided at that time to the question of manpower for slave labor enterprises, the war economy, and what was happening in concentration camps as a potential reserve of manpower for these purposes. By mid-1944, there were relatively few Jewish prisoners in the long-standing concentration camps in the Alt Reich and Austria. Even in the concentration camps that had been established in occupied Poland after the war began, they were not a conspicuous national group. A dramatic change became in the middle of 1944. It was the time of the great deportation of Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz. At that time, after obtaining Hitler's go-ahead, Himmler authorized the transfer of Jews from Hungary to concentration and labor camps associated with the munitions and armament industry. In the second half of May 1944, as trains bearing Hungarian Jews clattered into the camp, other trains began to leave Auschwitz, delivering thousands of those of these Jews to concentration camps elsewhere in Poland or in Germany. The removal of Hungarian Jews to labor camps in the Reich and Poland lasted throughout the summer and encompassed tens of thousands. About one-fourth of the 300,000 Hungarian Jews who reached Auschwitz in the spring and summer of 1944 were shipped out to concentration and labor camps in Germany or Poland instead of being sent to the gas chambers. The policy was implemented to other transport which arrived at Auschwitz from other countries, France, Greece, Italy, or Poland. That means that presumably 25 to 30% of the Jews who reached Auschwitz in the spring and summer of 1944 had the good fortune of being selected for labor and not, at least right away, for the gas chambers. In the last year of their existence, a new and different process began at the concentration camps, and it was implemented toward Jewish and non-Jewish alike. This extermination process, unlike that of previous years, was calculated and programmed under considerations of economy, costs, production, and output. In these considerations, the process of extermination and exploitation was so interwoven and interconnected that they had become inseparable. The extermination of the prisoners, however, was not the main purpose of the concentration camps, almost all of which had become giant slave labor complexes. The ability to work was a criterion that drew a clear line of demarcation between life and death. Prisoners whose strength expired often died on the job. It was a matter of selective extermination in which the victims were selected not on the basis of political and above all racial terror, like the victims of the Nazi genocide in the main extermination years between 1941 and 1944, but rather in accordance with their physical capacity and ability to work. Thus, in their last year, the camps became giant labor and extermination facilities that housed members of all races and political groups, that the regime had labeled as dangerous enemies of the Aryan race. These prisoners fused into a collective that had no defined identity other than the instrumental identity that could be exploited until it could be no longer serve the war effort. When the great German retreat began in the winter of 1944-1945, the masses of prisoners were evacuated and sent out on death marches. They were the last victims of Nazi genocide. If so, the final stage of Nazi genocide was the continuation of events that in the camps and in the months leading to after the evacuation. The test is to examine where it stood in the great demarche of Nazi genocide and to probe the commonalities and differences between them and what had been done until late 1940. The demarche period is different from preceding periods of Nazi genocide, mainly due to the victim's identity. However, even though this large group of prisoners was an incorrect mess, a melange of political, ethnic, national, and racial groups, it was finally identified as a collective that exhibited uniform characteristics and behavior. The common denominator of this collective was, for most, the basically imaginary and imagined threat that it posed to its murderers. The rhetoric that accompanied the perpetrators for and the perpetrators of various slaughters during the death marches give evidence to the fear and sense of urgency and the extension and the existence of need to obliterate this enemy. However, unlike a genocide that targets all or part of the nation or a collective of mass elimination, as had happened in previous years, the murderers' intention in the death marches was not to murder all members of the group, but had been targeted for eradication all the prisoners, but only some of them in accordance with the changing interests and institutions. Let me sum up with the question of the legal definition regarding that final phase of the genocide. The difficulty in defining and characterizing the crimes committed during the death march period in the broad context of the Nazi genocide is a conspicuous one. The legal system does not offer us much help. Just as the tribunal in Nuremberg found it hard to define the Nazis' crime in 1945, so in the cases of genocide and massacre, as the war wounded down, the tribunal and the judge, the concentration camp criminal, did not know how to tackle this question. From 1946 on, dozens of war criminals were placed on trial before the Allied special military tribunals for crimes perpetrated in concentration camps. The Americans conducted military trials in Dachau for criminals from Buchenwald, Dachau, Flossenbürg, Mauthausen, and Mittelbau-Dora camps. The British tried the criminals from Ravensbrück and Neuenbrandenburg in Hamburg, the criminals of Bergen-Belsen in Lüneburg, and the last commander of Nazweiler Stutthof and several guards at this camp in Württemberg. The Red Army military tribunal brought the criminals of Sachsenhausen to trial in Berlin. In subsequent trials in Poland, the German Federal Republic, and Austria, hundreds of persons who had served in concentration camps were prosecuted, included the soul who had escorted prisoners on the death march. However, the courts and tribunals found it difficult to prove the guilt of specific individuals, most of them who were low-ranking camp guards, random murderers who had not pressed the trigger more than one or at the most several times. The survivors had difficulty identifying them, let alone knowing their names after liberation. These were murderers of a different kind, and the instances that were asked to adjudicate their crimes, usually in the 1960s and the 1970s, did not view them as responsible in any way for more than the murder or the non-occurrence abuse of an individual prisoner or at the most a small group of prisoners. Naturally, the question of complete culpability for participating in the crime of genocide attracted no attention in this trial. In that case, as much as proven before, the court doesn't provide us always with the accurate tool to understand the historical phenomenon. And it is our responsibility, historians, sociologists, political scientists, and jurists, to find a common denominator for cooperation. It is our task to research, understand, educate, and punish. But what is most important is to do everything within our power to prevent these horrors to be